and welcome to this week's Expert HR podcast with me, Jennifer Richalvin. Lots of employees still struggle to effectively tackle underperforming employees or embed performance management procedures within their organisations. With me to explore why this is Expert HR consultant editor Darren Newman. Darren joins us on the phone from Cambridge. Hi, Darren.
Hi, Jo. Thanks for having me.
So why do you think this is? It's not because there isn't lots of information out there, is it?
No, and I don't think it's because the law's too complicated. Frankly, the law on unfair dismissal when it comes to poor performance is quite straightforward. I think it's a more human problem than that. I think it's just a difficult thing for managers sometimes to have the sort of conversations that you have to have with an employee whose performance just isn't up to scratch.
And so do you think is it a lack of confidence or a lack of competence or a lack of training or a bit of all three?
I think it's a combination of all three. I think it's partly a confidence thing, but it's partly, it's a very unpleasant task, and we naturally try to put off very unpleasant tasks.
And in terms of the kinds of problems that can lead to, I mean, procrastination in terms of handling poorly performing employees isn't good for anyone, is it?
No, in employment law terms, someone's much more likely to get in trouble for not dealing with a problem than they are for dealing with a problem too early. And what we tend to find is that someone puts up with poor performance for years, potentially on end, and then eventually their patient snaps and suddenly they decide that somebody absolutely needs to leave the organisation. And the problem they've got then is they'd have to persuade the tribunal that this person's performance had been dreadful for all this time and they hadn't done anything about it, and now something had changed that justified suddenly taking action. And that can be quite difficult.
Yeah, and unless there's sort of some actual external event or something that you can point to, I would have thought that would be an uphill struggle.
It can be, yes. I mean, the employer can always draw a line in the sand and essentially say to the employee, look, we're sorry, we've given you the impression that your performance up to now has been fine, but in fact it hasn't been, and this is what we're going to need from you. But I think if that's the situation, the tribunal's going to expect an employer to show a certain degree of patience with an employee, because they, after all, have given the employee the understanding or the impression that their performance is good enough.
So actually, both parties having really clear expectations about what's expected is crucial.
I think that's really standard to a lot of employment law, you know. I think it's one of the most crucial things, just to have very clear standards that are clearly communicated so that everyone knows where they stand.
So you talk to HR departments a lot about this. What kinds of tips do you give them when you're addressing this issue?
Well, I think it does come down to trying to get problems dealt with at an early stage rather than a late stage, so that people can actually grasp the nettle and have those awkward conversations that will hopefully stop more formal processes having to come in the future. But I think the other key thing is to have a clear idea of the level of performance that you expect from employees. And lots of employers don't necessarily understand that they're entitled to get good performance from employees. They're entitled to insist on employees doing a good job. There's actually been a very interesting case, well, I might be overstating how interesting it is, but a recent case, Elmore against the governors of Darland High School, that was about the dismissal of a teacher for poor performance. And one of the underlying issues was that her performance was being measured on the basis of lesson observations. And she was given the standard that out of 8 lesson observations, at least one of them had to be good. And in fact, the best she managed was adequate. And one of the arguments she put forward was that, how can it be fair to dismiss someone for poor performance if the actual measurement is showing that they are adequate at the job? And one of the points that the tribunal made was an employer is entitled to set the standard and is entitled to require people to be better than that and to be good. It's all about just having clarity about what you expect.
So that's absolutely crucial, isn't it, that employers are actually confident enough to set the standard that they want employees to reach. So in terms of giving feedback then to an underperforming employee, I'm assuming it's important to be as concrete and as particular as you can when you're saying where they're going wrong.
Yes, I think first of all the feedback needs to be given as promptly as possible. There's no good waiting until someone's annual appraisal and then saying, oh, by the way, I didn't like the way you finished this project 6 months ago. Something has to be done at really quite an early stage. It needs to be constructive. It needs to be not personal. It needs to be focused on what someone could have done better. But also the employer needs to be clear about where their expectations are and how far below that expectation the conduct has fallen. If ultimately an employee is going to end up losing their job because their performance isn't good enough, they have to be told that that's where they're going from an early stage so that they know how serious the issue is.
So they need to be clear about timescales and need to be clear about the consequences of not improving within those timescales.
Exactly, yes. And that takes debate about what a fair process is when we're looking at poor performance, which is the opportunity to improve. That once you've explained to an employee that their performance isn't at the right level and what the consequences would ultimately be of their performance not improving, you then need to give them the opportunity to reach that new level. And that's going to be a different process for different employers depending on the nature of the job.
And in terms of other tools like coaching, training, etc., have you got anything that you want to add on that?
I make my living partly as a trainer, so I'm the last person in the world to tell people not to send people on training courses. So yeah, training can be part of the overall mix. But I have to say, frankly, it's about having managers with a level of skill that allows them to bring the best out of people and helps them have those awkward conversations in a way that doesn't make people feel alienated or bullied or discriminated against. And frankly, if you've got managers who are good at that, then hold on to them.
So that integration is kind of feedback and training into somebody's everyday working life, isn't it?
Yeah, we often talk about performance management as being this sort of final stage that we go through just before we're legally allowed to dismiss somebody. And it's important to bear in mind that performance management is really just management. That's what management is all about.
Tell us about, there's been a recent case, hasn't there, which talked about redeployment in the context of poorly performing employees. We're used to hearing about that in terms of ill health, but we're not as used to hearing about any kind of obligation to redeploy in the context of poor performance.
That's right, yes. It's a case called Owajobi against London Borough of Lewisham. And it caught my eye, really, because we don't see very many performance dismissal cases in the tribunals. If we look at the leading cases, they're actually from the 1970s. That tell us about the need to give people an opportunity to improve and that sort of thing. So this was a case where an employee was going through a performance management process and the question arose as to whether it was a local authority employer, so there were other vacancies within the organisation, and the question arose as to whether it would be appropriate to consider whether the employee could fill those other vacancies instead of the one where she was poorly performing. And the employer took a decision not to consider that, not to specifically look at those vacancies, because they decided that the way in which her performance was below standard would have applied no matter what job she was in, and so really they'd have just been transferring the problem to another department. And that was held to be okay, that was held to be fair at the EAT level. So it basically tells us that there's no specific obligation to consider alternative work when you're looking at dismissing someone for poor performance.
And was that a surprising decision to you or not?
I don't think it was surprising necessarily, because in many ways, whenever you're looking at an unfair dismissal claim, it's really all about the circumstances of the case and what's considered to be reasonable. So it's very rare to get specific rules. But it's an interesting illustration that you don't necessarily need to go through that formal stage. It's also worth bearing in mind that there might be circumstances where that's absolutely what you need to do. If what's happened is the employee is performing poorly because you've mistakenly promoted them to a job that they can't do, then I think a reasonable employer might well think, well, could we reasonably take them back to the job that they were doing so well before? So there's certainly going to be circumstances where alternative work is a thing to look at. And of course, if there's a disability in play, and we're looking at the duty to make reasonable adjustments, well, that's a whole other ballgame. So, but in terms of the standard case, I think it was an interesting illustration.
Thanks very much, Darren. Before I let you go, I wanted to ask you, because we've obviously had the Taylor review out.
Oh, have we? Has that been in the news?
This week. So tell us, what are your thoughts?
Do you know what? I have been through the Taylor review, and my first view is that it's more substantive than the leaks that we've had in recent days actually suggest. There's an awful lot of detailed work in there proposing changes to employment law that I think are very interesting and potentially could have a major impact. The problem is we're all distracted by one of the first proposals they make, which is about employment status. And I think the report is hopelessly optimistic if it thinks that we can just come up with a new definition of employees and workers that will suddenly be clear and everyone will know exactly where they stand. I think what we'll do is we'll just end up with a new definition that's just as unclear as anyone we've got, and we'll just have a whole new set of case law issues to deal with. And I can't tell you how much I don't like this idea of calling workers dependent contractors. Once you try and actually slot that into the legislation as it already exists, the amount of complications it causes compared to the amount of benefit you get from it, I think it's really not worth doing. But look further down the report, look at things about written statements of terms and conditions and who should get them and whether you can go to an employment tribunal to establish your employment status without a fee. I think there are all sorts of interesting proposals in there that should keep us picking over for a few years.
Thanks very much, Darren.
Thanks, Jo. Happy to join you.
We have a wealth of guidance on the subject of underperformance on the site, including line manager briefings on capability and handling difficult conversations, and a how-to guide on handling an underperforming employee. Well, that brings us to the end of this week's Expert HR podcast. Thanks for listening. We're back again next Friday. But until then, it's goodbye from us.